This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Men Talk on Plains FM 96.9. A playful search for understanding and appreciation of men. Your hosts are Donald Pettit from Canterbury Men's Centre and me, Ian Ferguson, coordinator of International Men's Day in New Zealand. Today we talk to Warwick Pudney about the history of the men's movement in New Zealand. This show is supported by the Christine Taylor Foundation for Mental Health.
Thanks for coming along today, Warwick. You're a person who has been very influential in the men's movement over the many years. Can you say a bit about yourself first?
At the moment, I am a program leader in violence and trauma studies at Auckland University of Technology. Within that, I like particularly to cover the men's aspect of violence and trauma. But of course, my history goes back into setting up and managing an NGO in West Auckland around working with men who've been referred for violence or abuse, harmful behaviour. And before that, I go back into working with and helping set up a sex offender, community sex offender agency program in Auckland. On Men's Line, I was involved in setting up a Men's Line.
Which was a men's phone line service.
Yeah.
What is a men's movement? Have you got a definition in your mind for what that would have been?
Well, a large group shift in consciousness, I think, that brings a particular influential perspective to what's happening in the national community.
When would you have first put the word men's movement out there? When would you first identify something like this happening?
I recall a time in my late 20s, early 30s, where I'd been pondering for I think, literally decades around feminism and its influence and what it was saying and what we needed to listen to. And so I remember joining around about age 30, a group of men who were wanting to do consciousness-raising stuff with the idea of setting up some assistance for men. But looking at those issues and where might we evolve something to come in and what sort of perspective would we have on it? And we fought and struggled over it, trying to use consensus in a group that became entrenched in two or three different positions, and so it became a power issue. But that was a wonderful place, really, for thinking and training in this whole area, because out of that, the change makers were the people who said, "Well, okay, we want to do something to help in male-female relationships and men in families and help men think differently about themselves and their relationships and do other things like stop topping themselves and live happier." Yeah.
When would that have been? What years? Like, when would you have been a 20, 30-year-old man?
Well, that's giving the game away totally,
yeah,
isn't it?
Sorry, yeah, man.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of that thinking was evolving through to the 20s, but this particular group where we were trying to nail something was when I was about 30.
And that would be
2010?
Yeah, that'll do. No, I think we better get historically accurate here and say that would have been in 1980.
And you mentioned two or three different branches or you know, divergent thought lines. And can you tell me what those were?
Well, particularly, there was somebody sitting in a very heavy feminist position, which was useful to us because that was a position we had encountered it. It was part of us. And we were trying to work out how men could regard themselves in a better light so that they could actually shift into that light in a way. And without losing feminism, but could actually be more empathic to the male condition, as in, you know, if that's how men are, why are they like that and how can we help them? It became clear to us that you weren't going to make men any better by man-bashing. You actually had to sit with it and think empathically about why might they want to top themselves? Why might they want to walk out of a family? Why might they be sacked from a family? What actually is going on here? And looking at fairness, looking at the fairness of feminism, but also the fairness of men's lives. And I guess my dad in some ways was, I don't think the word's inspiration, but it was a model that I wanted to kick in a way, because he worked his socks off doing overtime, trying to pay the mortgage, and was a slave to it out of believing that was his role and duty. And in the end, my parents' relationship broke up and he was left a very lonely and disappointed and disillusioned man. And I didn't want to be like that.
When I think of the positions that might have emerged, there was an entrenched feeling of we have to hold them responsible versus a practical approach, which is sympathetic with that, but, you know, holding men responsible, but at the same time, sympathetically engaging with them and getting curious about them.
Yeah, we were investigating positive masculinity and where it wasn't positive, what would positive masculinity look like? And of course, we trod a difficult political line because on one side, there was the all men are bad group. And on the other side is you can't take away a victimhood from women. You know, I remember at one point we set up a men's refuge. We set it up because there was a very real need for men who had been in so much conflict in their homes that it was appropriate that they leave them. And so how would they retain links and time with their children? How would they change behaviour if, in fact, they needed to change behaviour? How would we deal with the thing of them at the same time as wanting to be away from their partners, wanting to spend time with them and not reveal where the refuge was? So, a lot of tricky stuff there.
And whatever happened to the refuge?
Well, I think we went for about 4 or 5 years and then we packed it in because of funding. The thing is, it's much easier. I mean, you'd know this from the centre. It's much easier to give a woman funds to assist themselves because there's quite a strong profile out there of women as victims of male harm. When you talk to funders about giving men to men's projects, then they have to get past this thing of, well, why would we give money to such a bad cause in a way? And getting through that, we're about changing stuff and turning this into a good cause. I remember one case of that type of giving was we were setting up the beginnings of a sex offender program. Somebody had been working for about a year in the basement of a church on a basic feelings and behaviour level, supporting men to be different. And an application was made to a very prominent brewery for funding. In the end, they said, listen, we're going to give you some money, a reasonable amount of money, at least pay the rent, but please don't tell anyone where it came from.
Well, speaking, and I will speak for the Canterbury Men's Centre in the sense, I think we're not in the contested fields of domestic violence.
Yes, yeah.
Funders have been great. I was fearful when we set up that we might have people just say, nah, because it's men, but they're really keen for men to be taken care of and they're open to a solution. And I've had quite a number of funders, as well as many people in the health and social sector, say, thank God you're there.
Yeah.
Because to be fair, I think they didn't want to do it, but they wanted somebody to do it.
Yeah, because we moved later on to a position where it was a case of, hang on, we're doing all this work with women. Oh, what are you guys, like, we don't want to do the guy work.
Yeah.
What are you guys doing about this? So the responsibility sort of came back by way of a challenge there, but also we're going to support you to do this. We support you in two ways. We're interested in how you're working and we'd like an input in that. But at the same time, needs to be done by men under the same flag as women working for women.
There's so many branches and questions I could be asking you right now, Warwick. Any particular arcs that you think have covered this period?
I think what's been important, and it's a process that we went through before setting up Man Alive in West Auckland, and full credit to a smart community. We've done some smart things in West Auckland for within our community and tried out new projects and so on. We said, we're not going to set up this organisation until we're really clear about what we're doing. And the men said, until women actually understand where we're coming from on this. Because I have questions, as a number of us did, about if men are only helping men to rescue women, I don't know if we're going to get anywhere out of that, because we'll lock people into those guys are bad and women are harmed roles. So what evolved out of fortnightly meetings of a network that went for 18 months, that enabled us to change a lot of consciousness in our whole community, the men and the women, as we listened to each other about what the work might be like and what it does. And I remember particularly we looked at men and their power, which is appropriate from a feminist model. We looked at women and their powerlessness from the same feminist model. And it's easy to understand those juxtaposed against each other. But then we started looking at woman's power using perhaps more of a personal growth model. And what is the power that women have, running through from things as obvious as childbirth through to some advantage in the family court and so on. So when we looked at all of those things, women's skills in the relational field, women's the power of beauty, we were starting to get a bit more balance in the picture. But then we went to men's powerlessness, and because the women had worked so much with powerless women, they had problems seeing and sensing the powerlessness of men. And it took a lot of time and patience, and by them as much as anything, but us as well. We had to find the words to express that. It hadn't really been done very well before in a way that people could hear it. But we got that through, and it wasn't easy, but working from that position of men helping men from a place of recognising that men will be able to hear men's stories. You know, I tell the story perhaps around my dad working his butt off and dying an unhappy man, through to other stories about men. Looking at the statistics was shocking, and saying, we're here to help those guys. And if we do changes with those guys, if we help those guys and we bring them to a positivity about themselves and a love of mankind, then they're going to be different in their homes. They're going to be different with their sons. They're going to be different with their partners. They're going to be more empathic. And that's good for everybody. And that was right.
So an exploration of men's powerlessness.
Yeah. Yeah. Developing a narrative there about men's reality was so important.
And finding a way that other people can understand it.
That's it. Yes. I recall a couple of really good women decided that it would be too hard for them to do.
I was curious about that group, and I'm trying to imagine it. Would there be like 10 of you having a dinner together in a community hall or something?
Yeah, yeah.
And who would you have drawn from to do that? Like some local stakeholders or counselors or
local stakeholders, particularly the agencies dealing in one way or other with family violence.
And at the same time, this is happening. I assume the women's movement is developing, refuges are developing, and services developing around the country.
Those particular set of meetings happened around about 1990. So that, if we go back, there would have been a decade of work before we got to that point. And it was an evolution. We were working with men in that time and trying to do some of that. But I think developing that narrative around the reality that men live in, and then finding a way to talk to others about that.
Were there any models as you were creating this that you were going back to and, you know, old truths that provided you guidance?
I'm not quite sure what you mean about old truths, but many of the old sayings.
Did they come to mind?
Around gender. Well, they've been evolved in such a sexist context that I think that's more difficult. One of the things I did do with a group of telephone counsellors in Auckland at Lifeline was run a workshop. We got sets of men's clothing, full sets of men's clothing, and we laid them out on chairs in the workshop. And the workshop was taken by men who are interested in doing this and building empathy for men, because we were also setting up the men's telephone line at the time, and asked the women to enter and put those clothes on and enter into the reality of the characters. And they've been given a biography, a profile that they were asked to act into, which of course is something that people do in role plays and training counsellors. And we worked for about an hour and a half in those, talking about how it felt to be in those positions, counselling people in those positions. Until the end, it was only women dressed up as men. After about an hour and a half, the woman said, "My God, this is terrible in these clothes. Can we take these off now?" So we did. And then we had a talk about where that came from. It was fascinating. And it was one of the most useful exercises we'd done in terms of assisting.
For them to physically wear their men's clothes.
Yes.
And what do you think was behind that?
As a men's centre, you'd be aware about those statistics about men's difficulties and so on. And you front them up with a lack of language to talk about it as well. It's an imprisonment of pain almost for many of those men.
And you've mentioned language a few times while we've been talking so far. What more could you say about language that you found?
I think languaging men around their emotions has been a major step, assisting men to actually say what it is. I remember one of the programs, it was a men's men helping men support group. We were doing some of this emotional languaging. What struck myself and the other trainer was the guy started using a word. Because I had a lack of precision about language, they started using this word that was actually introduced by my colleague called the unbearable feeling. It describes how they're experiencing it. Then the two other words, which you can probably think of as, you know, some of these guys can only nail two emotions and they both start with F. So if we got them into saying the unbearable feeling, which also covers a lot of emotions from sadness, the key thing about it is it expresses vulnerability instead of anger or aggression.
So pushing away,
yeah.
Very much more about an ownership of that feeling.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, why do you think men don't have the language to express themselves? Did they not learn it when they were growing up, or what's the story?
Sure, they didn't learn it when they were growing up. Yeah, they didn't have the emotional recognition at an early age, and I think that's been the product of the time. I think things have changed quite a lot. Certainly hope they have. But this whole thing, I mean, one of the examples that I've used in talking with people, when I went to, I took my daughter to a play centre for a couple of years, and I was listening to the language used by the, at that point, primarily mothers, and you'd have this phenomena of if a girl, say, fell over and grazed her knee, it would be, "Oh, you poor thing, that must have hurt. Oh, let's go and put a plaster on it." Okay, so it's loaded with empathy and recognition of the hurt and the vulnerability. Boy the same age, this literally happened to me, a boy the same age did the same thing, fell over, scraped his knee, we got, "There, there, what a brave little boy. That didn't hurt you, did it?" So you got a training of denial of vulnerable emotions right back then. This is the 3-year-olds I'm talking about here. And so if you've got pain, then you don't disclose it. You've got to be brave. Of course, the language gets tougher as they get older. Don't be a wuss and things like this.
Sarah, I've heard it said that most people think it's men doing this more, but there's research showing it's actually women and mothers in particular that are doing this.
Yeah, we got to think about this. We're all doing it. We're all doing it. And particularly mothers are in a position of privilege, I think, and that they tend to spend more time with children. And there's a real responsibility in doing that. And we, both men and women, we're loaded with these ideas about men being provided. It's still, that's one of the biggest ones that's changed, but it's still there, and you really see it at antenatal classes, that men beginning to, it dawns on them that they are going to be the number one. They are going to be, even if it's only for 3 months, it really hits them.
That they're going to be fathers?
No, that they're going to be providers and start thinking about that. And I've interviewed so many men around antenatal stuff. I'm staggered that the antenatal programs in this country are not that great. Now, the government's paying money to agencies to run these programs, and there are two variables in it. One is the content. Is the content equally inclusive of men? And the other one is, are the stories being told by the women facilitators of antenatal programs, are they fair and inclusive, or do they carry the difficulties of that particular woman's life? And I've seen some absolutely wonderful top class antenatal facilitators, woman facilitators, so I'm happy to go there, but I've seen some pretty sad models come through from and stuff around women and men and men's attitudes, women's attitudes to men and babies come through, and that's been a shame. There's a whole lot of work still to be done on this.
Yeah, definitely. I got, certainly got the message at the two antenatal classes groups I went to, 8 classes each for my 2 children, that I've gotten the message both times that I'm kind of an adjunct.
Yeah, yeah.
They might have even said I'm a co-parent, but it sure didn't feel like that. I know it's about birthing and so on, but definitely I didn't feel like I was going to be an equal parent because of that. I was told to pretty much shut up.
Yeah, well, how about the one when you've got a room full of 11 couples, male and female. So 11 men in the room, 12 women. There was only one person there who didn't have a partner then. It's because her partner was away on work duties. And the facilitator refuses to call them fathers. She calls them partners, or support person was probably the most used term.
That's completely interchangeable with any other person, isn't it, a support person?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, like you could bring your mum along. I'm all for anybody supporting anybody, but hang on, you've got an important equal partner, I hope, in this business of bringing a child into the world and supporting it.
But I do remember seeing one of the old Caritani nurse booklets. They talked about how to take care of the husband. They were telling the mom, listen, you're going to be at home. He's going to be working his butt off. How are you guys going to work it out? And they were really keen about the woman also stepping up in terms of seeing her husband's taken care of. I would hope the guy would be getting that message as well in ways, But I don't think there'd be that many people that would read that and think, oh, that's a great idea. That, actually women need to be coached about how to, work with that dad in a loving way and how to take care of his needs. I'm not saying, give sex away or something or whatever, but, something about, recognizing that he's going to go through a real big hiccup as well, especially if it's his first time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Sex was one of the issues in the
one of the topics.
Yeah, a lot of the men are going through a process of being feeling unimportant and rejected. I think men may see sex as a more physical activity.
And affirming, very much affirming of the relationship at a...
Absolutely.
And that disappears, and this lovely little person comes along who they're bonded to. I suspect it's not that different now, though, because men, my experience and maybe your recent one, where we didn't talk about that so much, the loss of that. And
I think maybe some younger women coming into the administration and management of those programs would be a good idea.
Would be good. Okay. Maybe there's legacies. We advance one tombstone at a time.
One thing that I found interesting when talking about supporting fathers is there was a art show of photographs of dads, and that was organized by the Ministry for Women, because having dads at home doing more domestic stuff helps women. I was a little bit kind of disappointed that the framing of it was we support dads because it supports mums, not support dads because we need to support.
Precisely, yeah, absolutely. That's back to that old thing of helping men only because you want to help women. And I can understand women working with women having that idea. But what is needed, I think, is men working with men for the better engagement, the better well-being of men, and that includes relationships with partners.
I've heard it said quite harshly on the internet, the men, women have problems, men are problems.
That's so sad.
They're saying that's the framing, and that's,
yeah, it's appalling.
I see men as a part of the community that require community services,
yep,
as much and probably more so than women, given where we're standing right now. And
And here you, as men, managing the service, taking up that challenge and saying, okay, this is a responsibility of men to look after men. It's not all about expecting women to do this. And actually, you know a lot about men.
And what other arcs there? We're talking about fatherhood, transitions. There's the stopping violence movement. There's the anti-rape movement I've heard about. Put some names out there about aspects or threads to the movement.
I think in the 90s it started this thing about a wider awareness around men that had come out from feminism had begun to split off, and so we had a men's personal growth movement, and I would say personal nurture movement of growth and support of men that was responsible around men's well-being. But you also had a group of men who would have been a minority who were firmly entrenched in a feminist perspective and were quite anti-male. It was quite difficult being in conversations helping and supporting men because they riled at that.
It's interesting. You would think somebody could be a feminist and very supportive of men as well.
Probably in a way we are.
I would describe myself as a feminist by many definitions. I am, for example, and yet I'm very keen to take care of men at a compassionate level. And at the same time, when I come across some of the boundaries and some of the underpinnings, I balk at the many concepts that I think, well, actually, I can't describe to that. But definitely by some dictionary definitions, you and I would be, I imagine, feminists and same.
Now, at the same time there, you had a rising public profile of gay men as well. So there was a very strong and active branch of the men's movement. I think it's important to name the gay men's movement because they were a great model in a way for the hetero men, because they were up and doing it. They were providing specific...
They gathered.
Yeah, they were setting up specific services for themselves that heard their reality.
I've spoken to one man in particular who was a leader in that movement at the time, and on his reflection of history, you know, we lost it all once it became legal for us to be to be gay. He said, as soon as that happened, we all just disappeared. Especially after marriage, you know, he said we just didn't have a purpose anymore. So now we're all out in the suburbs in our own little bungalows, and he said there was a real loss with that. So,
that's fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I've never seen a men's movement like the, you know, people on the street. It's very unlikely in New Zealand. Can you say something about the ugly side of men, you know, on the streets? There have been some protests and marches over the years. Is there anything you reflect on there?
Well, if we could just recap on what was happening with the men around about the 90s and the early, particularly early 90s, there was another splinter group. So while you had a smaller group of men saying, we don't like men, and we firmly entrenched with a strong feminist position, and there was a lack of empathy. On the other hand, you had a group of men who were going on about men's rights, and I think they did some useful work. And I don't know if your mind goes back far enough to the Superman entrapped on London Bridge.
Oh, I've seen the images of that.
Yeah, and Batman on the balcony of Buckingham Palace and so on. So these are images out of that thing that was empathic to men, but it was actually firmly men's rights, and they got into some fairly direct conflict verbally with feminist movements.
I've certainly heard of one group that was protesting in front of judges' houses, for example, family court judges' houses. And I mean, that's something that it still lives. It's in the living memory of many court officials. And, you know, they were quite frightened. You know, a few people have mentioned that to me when they find out I'm advocating for men. They're afraid that I'll trigger some of that behavior again.
Yeah. Well, some of those men went to prison.
Yeah. Oh, did they go to prison?
Yeah. And I know a few who nearly went to prison. They got such a heavy warning, they thought, no, I've got my family and my kids to think about here.
So this was family court judges, the houses they were protesting outside of, is that right?
Also social workers, psychologists, but I think mainly it was around those type of figures here.
And that was those men had their relationship had broken down, and they were trying to get access to their children, and they felt they had a raw deal from all of those people.
That's just about it. Yeah, single dads, and also that smaller group of men got a lot of support from grandmothers, and who had through the court's action lost access to their grandchildren. And that was an important voice.
Can you say something more about, let's say, allies, never mind women allies, but other allies of the whole men's movement in the New Zealand context?
I think somebody's all straight off really has to use their voice, and groups using their voice and holding a presence, and that particular group that we were talking about did do that. There were those who immediately got oppositional to that, and, you know, what are they doing hanging around the front of courts for, and coming into courtrooms and disrupting hearings and so on. But there were others who were big enough to go, hang on, there's an issue here. Maybe we need to look more closely at this. And I'm aware of a couple of judges. There's the second judge who in particular said, I remember a conversation with him where he said, no, listen, we've got to do something about this. This whole thing around couples in the court has taken a very empathic swing through to hearing women's voices, but maybe we need to also listen to men's voices. So they started trying to open things up a bit more on that front, and that was sufficient, I think, for the movement to lose its sting a wee bit. And
so some movement by the family court, some engagement.
Yeah.
Were changes evolved out of that time?
I think we have a more fair system now than what we did in the 90s. Yes. There was another movement there which I was also part of, which was around the fatherhood movement, and A couple of us wrote books advocating fatherhood. I wrote a book around for new dads, and Rex McCann wrote a book around the relationships with fathers and what happens if that's not there. We had an organisation called, I think, Fatherhood New Zealand, and we were very active in doing things like putting out posters that went up on the walls of social services showing men combing their daughter's hair and things like this, lovely nurturing photos. And we generated some fathering programs, helping dads be better dads.
And what's become of those?
A lot of that sharp edge of it's gone and it's become more muffled, but some of those programs around fathering are still running, as they should. I think there's a strong need for them. But the actual organisations that were promoting it, I have pretty much, I think, dissolved.
Let's take a break and listen to On the Turning Away by Pink Floyd.
On the turning away from the pale and downtrodden and the words they say which we won't understand. Don't accept that what's happening is just a case of all the suffering, or you'll find that you're joining in the turning away. It's a sin that somehow light is changing to shadow and casting a shroud over all we have known. Oh, the world, how the ranks have grown, driven on by a heart of stone. We could find that we're all alone in the dream of the crowd. On the wings of the night, as the daytime is swirling, where the speechless unite in a silent accord, using what you will find the strange, mesmerized as they light the flame, feel the new wind of change.
Dream that there'll be no more turning away.
Can I just sort of circle back a wee bit? A couple of times, Warwick, you've talked about the feminist perspective, and I think I know what you're talking about, but our listeners might just need a little bit of clarification about, and when you said a couple of times that the feminist perspective is anti-male or something along those lines, can you just sort of clarify what you mean by that?
Well, I need to be clear that the feminist perspective is not necessarily anti-male, but I do think that back in the 80s and 90s, there was such a sharp edge around this I only advocate for women position as opposed to a more integrated and holistic approach to relationships. And so it did call men out to say, okay, well, you guys, you need to put some words to this. That was a good thing, and I was part of that. And I think you guys are still doing that. But if you feel like your voice isn't heard, which was true of the women operating in those times, 80s, 90s particularly, then women several times, said to me, I'm not going to pick up your cause. Don't expect me to advocate for this. I'm too busy trying to get a woman's voice heard. So that's not being anti-male. It's being very clear about being pro-feminist. Ultimately, you've got to look at all the parties involved and get something going that's informed by everything. But, of course, there were wounded, injured women, just like the wounded, injured men got into groups of being anti the other gender. And I think it all comes back to being personally injured on these things. Or if you work with clients continually and you're empathic to them, which means you identify with them, which means that's all you work with, that's the only stories that you hear. So that's how it must be in every relationship out there.
So a woman working in Women's Refuge who sees, you know, dozens of women with abusive male partners gets a kind of biased view from that work.
Of course. And if all you're working with is angry men, you get a biased view from that one too. So that's the importance of community services, NGOs, talking to each other and having people on each other's boards and checking out things with each other and maybe saying, hey, would you come along and take a session in our program? It's a trust-building exercise. And what we did in We're Talking With Men Alive would not have taken place if we hadn't gone through that long process of working with women's groups and to the point where the trust was there and we understood what each of us were trying to do. And we supported it. We got strong support from the women's agencies in the area, which is what you would hope we would have in a well-integrated and networked community.
But would you be able to say anything about politicians and political party engagement with the men's movement? Is there any particular standout responses or lack of responses that come to mind?
I remember when we did a conference in Christchurch and we had, is it your West Coast MP? Is it Damien O'Connor?
Damien O'Connor, yeah.
Came along and spoke, and I really appreciated the way he showed that he fully understood the plight of being male and being stripped of a lot of that relational sensitivity in this culture. So full marks to him. There are a lot of other politicians around who I would say were very sensitive to the democratic voting process and were not going to come too much over to listen to men, that they were going to do it from the sidelines because the votes were going to come from women. That's how democracy works. But
yeah, there's slightly more women voters than men voters.
Yeah, but the thing with harmed women, they gain more empathy than what men do. So if you're going for funding and you're talking about harmed women, you have a better chance of getting funding. And I'm quite happy with that. But
that reminds me, something I was thinking of earlier was that when we're talking about funding, there's often a limited pool of funding.
Yes.
And some people see that if we are funding men's services, then that's taking money away from women's services, and they have a problem with that kind of funding arrangement.
So it's a zero-sum game.
Yeah, we were aware of that, and I think at some stages that was possible. However, what we did, if you've got a men and women's agencies working together, we had a policy of putting on our funding applications. We understand in making this application that no funding will be taken away from women's programs. You guys, you funders, need to get it that this is looking at this holistically in an integrated way. You need to be funding both. So just up the money for both.
And I would point out that that's the male survivors of sexual abuse. National contracts have very much been upfront about that from the beginning. So I would think that's a really good indication of this is a partnership, and we want to, you know, we don't want to make you to make space for us. We want, you know, the society to make space for this to happen.
Yeah.
So it's a beautiful way to approach it.
And we'd have the support written in some form of a letter or something or other with those funding applications from the women's programs.
Where would you think we're going next? Or where are we now with the men's movement, looking at it from a historical granddaddy perspective?
Where to next? Number one, what social change movements have a problem that they very often are so intense around social change that they don't stop to look at their achievements. So they just shift the goalposts further away. And that's a shame. That's not a good practice, because you are continually operating over a period of time anyway with a sense of hopelessness that you're not making much difference. So we actually have to do some reflecting, particularly guys who've been through it this far, saying, hey, listen, we've made some difference. At the same time, we're still up against a lot of those things. We're not there yet. You know, some of the stories I've heard in the lockdown are around very traditional roles. What are the new edges? I really like that funding started moving towards men who are survivors of sexual abuse, and that specific programs and counselling is taking place there that recognises that the sexual abuse of men is different. So that's really good to see that going through. I've been wondering if we shouldn't be helping men with their grandfathering.
Grandfathering?
Yeah. I've talked to a lot of my students, and they around families and parents and where they got this and that from, and grandmothers feature a lot. Grandmothers do a lot of relational work with grandchildren. I don't hear too much about granddads, and I understand that that's because a lot of those granddads went through some very hard times in their life, the hard times that are related to the issues we've been talking about. But then also their models, if we look at things like intergenerational trauma. I'm old enough to say that I had two grandfathers attend World War One and die shortly after, not in the trenches, due to the effects of World War One. And I, therefore, here we are in 2020, unable to go to a grandfather figure in my life and go, okay, how do I do this? Where's my model? So I think some stuff around grandfathering. What else? Give me a lead in here, guys. What have you got on your minds?
Well, in Christchurch, we're just hoping to get a fathering project going with in fact, I think you participated in a consult I did last week. and ideas that people have come up with. People have talked about supervised access the men need probably by a male focused agency, with that, you know, being guys that seeing their kids through a family court, legal support, peer support for dads, dads groups going through separation. So this is all fatherhood related stuff. I mean, I could tell you all this. In fact, the Men's Center, I'm bragging a little bit, but we've got five really good projects that should be done every part of the country. Men's Sheds, that bloke's book, a large counseling social work service, the Male Survivors Project, and the Dads Project. Those five projects should be done in every center, and I'm assuming in four places in Auckland, and they should be funded by the national government, but they aren't. Local funders, once again, are very, very keen to do that support for dads. Oh, Male Survivors is funded nationally, by the way. I will acknowledge that.
So there you are. You refer to it as bragging, but I think that's such an important thing. What I mentioned about before is this thing of acknowledging what you've done, what you've achieved, and bragging. Wow.
Yeah, I don't feel it's about me at all in saying that. It's like we've done it. We've done it, and Canterbury's chosen to do it. And funders have said yes.
Yeah.
This really wouldn't be happening without them. And once again, all these people that have wanted it to go and to thrive, and they don't necessarily, again, want to do it, but they do want the best for men. And that's nice to be able to say.
Yes.
You know, that people genuinely and I think many people are surprised that people genuinely want the best for men. And and they just need to be reminded of that sometimes, I think.
So as we've been talking, a couple of things have come to my mind. And you're absolutely right on. You've got young men who need more training in how to be a dad and how to deal with breakups in the family. And there's a lot of hurt and disillusion guys out there. I know the service that we've had in Auckland has struggled financially in order to get funding and to perform all the tasks which are really necessary for those guys. They're the sort of guys, when you work with them, you think, oh my goodness, nothing much has changed. But it has. It's just that there is a cluster there, still an important cohort that needs help around breakups. What I know about fathering and the benefit that it is to both boys and girls tells me that if you can't do it for the dads, you should be doing it for the boys and girls. The other thing is I'm doing a lot of work at the moment with couples, and I'm staggered at the effect of poverty in young families. And I guess I'm in part of an Auckland where it's very evident. People, because they've come from disrupted families, they've not had love from their father. There's a lot of guys who are hurt, defensive, and hiding, and they're easy pickings for gangs. And the gangs actually supply something.
Connection.
Yeah.
Community.
Yeah. So we could do something like that. That doesn't mean to say, Donald, that you're going to have to put on your leather jacket. But, you know, maybe that is part of it. And maybe, we need a local chapter of the Men's Centre. So there's couples struggling. And I think a lot more help for couples. Some of them have got a long way to, a lot of stuff to get through to get there. But our kids deserve it.
You're hopeful?
I am, yeah. I feel like I'm way back at the beginning, actually, at the moment. Now, here's these people not being heard of, not being recognised, coming to a charitable organisation to try and get some help. And there just isn't enough of it, because the problem is just enormous. And we live in a society where men and women have attitudes of both men and women working. However, I notice when the relationship's in a rough time, the effect of the father not working, to me, appears to be greater than the effect of the mother not working. And it's not necessarily about who earns the most. It's about there is still a stereotype about the men as the bottom line breadwinner. When all else is done, he should be out there. And if he's not, he suffers. He feels like crap. And who wants to live with somebody who feels like that all the time? And at the same time, while he has that expectation, she does too. Like, I don't know if I want him around anymore if he's not employed.
What use is he? And we've certainly seen that. Susan Faludi wrote about that story of men. She described men's situation quite compassionately. Post-Detroit, I think it was recessions and women kicking men out because they weren't useful anymore. And,
yeah.
You know, as fathers and partners and people. And,
yeah.
But men get the point. They get the message, don't they? Conscious or not.
Yes.
Hey, we're getting close to the end. And if you had one magic wish, what would you wish for?
Oh, good question. I think the men who can do this work are out there. And I think they would love to do this work. It sounds rather trite, but I wish for money.
Okay, for that work.
To salary them so that they could do that work.
Well, thank you very much. As a father of the men's movement, Warwick, thank you very, very much for coming along today and having a chat with us about
this. It's lovely to chat with you about this stuff.
You want to say anything more, Ian, before we head out?
No, I've enjoyed it. It's good to get a lot more context, so thanks very much.